Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Susan Shapiro Barash, whose pen name is Susanna Marin, author of the new book, A Palm Beach Scandal. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. We are now in the very last week of the Hebrew calendar month of Elul, which means Rosh Hashanah and the Jewish New Year of 5781 are coming up fast. And for some of us, perhaps everyone in the world this year, this very troubled old year of 5780 can't end soon enough. And the new year, bringing the promise of positive change, or at least real potential for much better news, can't begin soon enough. Rosh Hashanah begins this Friday night at sundown, September 18th, and continues September 19th for Reform Jews and on into September 20th for Conservative and Orthodox Jews. Rosh Hashanah is always a time to reflect on the past year, our accomplishments and errors, whether we lived up to our goals for ourselves or failed to meet them. This is the season of tshuva, for return and repentance, seeking to return to being the best person we can be. It's a time to ask forgiveness from anyone we may have offended, to apologize for not being the person we wish we were. It's when we try to make the coming year a better year for ourselves, our families, and our friends. That work we must do for ourselves. This is also a time to assess what we expected the last 12 months to be, and to see how accurate our predictions were for our own lives. And when I think back on where we were 12 months ago, heck, 6 or 7 months ago, I find it very hard to imagine anyone could have predicted where we are right now. I mean, frankly, God, we can use a little help trying to understand what's happened since last Rosh Hashanah. This has been the strangest year most of us, pretty much all of us, have ever experienced. I don't think anyone out there predicted back last Rosh Hashanah that this Rosh Hashanah would take place in the midst of a slow-moving pandemic that would paralyze most of our societies all around the world and leave us wondering what the future would bring, for real. I'm pretty sure that about 50% of the ads I see on Facebook now are for custom face masks. Who exactly predicted that would be true last Rosh Hashanah? There's a passage in the book of Isaiah in which Isaiah says, Lo Navi velo ben Navi, I'm not a prophet, and I am not the son of a prophet. Well, if Isaiah could claim not to be a prophet, and he was genuinely one of the greatest of all prophets, well, who are we to claim to have any idea what'll happen in the future, especially after this last 7 or 8 months? So this Rosh Hashanah, this unique beginning to what will be a very different year, for sure, we here on 2 Jewish promise not to make any predictions for this coming year. Because anybody who thinks they know what the future holds is making it up. That we can be quite sure about. One thing we do know. Rosh Hashanah gives us a chance to start over. Something we kind of need to do this time around, don't we? And so to play us in this morning, here's the a cappella group 613 with their original Rosh Hashanah song, Starting Over.
It's Rosh Hashanah. All the time keeps ticking on. Just another year of moments come and gone. We're that much older. But are we wiser? Have our hearts grown that much colder? And have we ceased to do our part, 'cause I'm starting over. I'm looking back, 'cause I've done things that I'm not proud of. In this year we're coming out of, now's the time for introspection, time to forge a new direction, decide who I wanna be. A brand new year, a brand new me, 'cause I'm starting over. Blow the shofar, sound the call for us to change. This year is over, we'll renew ourselves again. The gates are open, I'll repent and swallow pride. And I'm hoping it's enough to be inscribed. I'm starting over, I'm looking back, 'cause I've done things that I'm not proud of. In this year we're coming out of, now's the time for introspection, time to forge a new direction, decide who I wanna be. A brand new year, a brand new me, I'm starting over. I'm moving past, I'm putting all my sins behind me. The errors of old ways won't find me. Let's return and seek forgiveness. Be what it means to be a Jew.
That was 613, better known for covers and parodies, with their original song for Rosh Hashanah, Starting Over. So as part of Starting Over, we've come up with a unique idea at my own synagogue, Congregation Beit Simcha, here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. This coming Saturday night, September 19th at 7:30 p.m., we're going to have a drive-in second night Rosh Hashanah celebration at the Gaslight Theater North. We can accommodate about 100 cars for an in-person, safe, socially distanced program of great music, inspiration, prayer, live shofar, hygienically distributed honey cake, and a chance to see and hear in person, in 3D, a full Rosh Hashanah fun, energized experience. We'll have big video boards everybody be able to see, professional sound so everyone can hear. You can put your chairs outside your car in your own safe space, and great leaders of the service, or experience, I say modestly, to bring in the 5781 New Year, which we hope and fervently pray will be a whole lot better than 5780 proved to be. Our hopes that everyone in our Jewish community wants to be part of this. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675 to sign up for this unique drive-in celebration of the Jewish New Year Saturday night. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Susan Shapiro Barish, who writes best-selling fiction under the pen name Susanna Marin, explains how her studies of women and women's issues in her 15 nonfiction books led her to a successful career as a novelist and what Judaism has to do with all of it. Find out in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. The High Holy Days are coming up this Friday, Saturday, and the following week, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Join Beit Simcha for our unique blended online and very limited live seating by calling 520-276-5675. Or emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org or go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org. Don't miss our live drive-in second night celebration on September 19th, Saturday night, with music, shofar, and much more, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and friends. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus sorus, join us every Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beitsimcha Tucson. We'll hold services with full music by virtual experience for the time being, with a very limited number of blended people allowed to be there. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, a great array of them. You can access that by emailing us at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogue's at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla on the north side, on the entrance to the Foothills Mall. Not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. For now, we're a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook with some blended services. Email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, to get more information on Beit Simcha. To attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and of course all of our services, both on Zoom and Facebook, go to beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's beitsimchatucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish community in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Susan Shapiro Barash, is a better known, I guess I should say your pen name is Susanna Marin, author of A Palm Beach Wife and a variety of other books. Her new book is called A Palm Beach Scandal, and it's just released. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
So you've written 13 nonfiction women's issue books and then some wildly successful fiction. What do you feel like you have a different identity when you write fiction?
Well, I do, because I have a different name. And of course, and it's such a different genre. It's such a different discipline. Writing is writing, and it's not for the faint of heart. But what I've done with my fiction is I've taken all my studies for the nonfiction books, a look at mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law. I've looked at remarriage and the role of wife in America, female rivalry, female infidelity, how toxic friendships play out for women, and I've incorporated it into the stories that I'm now writing.
Do you enjoy fiction more than nonfiction?
Oh, that's such a good question. I really love both. I love both ways of writing and getting the word out. I just think that fiction is something you really control, if that's the right word. I mean, you don't have to wait for an interview to understand, you know, that enlightens you in some way. You just create the character and she does what you hope she'll do.
Do your characters take on a life of their own? I mean, do they turn out the way you think they're going to turn out when you start the book?
Pretty much. Maybe because I come from the nonfiction world, I do an annotated outline of each chapter. You know, really the whole entire book, I know the ending and I know how certain people I'm creating interact before I even begin.
You know, I've interviewed a number of authors and everybody has a slightly different method. Did you develop that because nonfiction requires such a structured approach?
It's very structured, and it really is the template I'm accustomed to. So, for instance, I had an idea that women in our society keep a lot of secrets, that they have secrets in order to appear a good girl, a good wife, a good mother, good grandmother. But the faces women wear versus how they really feel is something I've noted in all of my nonfiction, and it's really been my life's work. So I think that for those books, I have a concept, really a thesis, and then I interview women all across the country, different ages, social strata, ethnicity, race, religion, in, you know, cities, small towns, all over, to see how they feel as mothers, as daughters, as colleagues, as daughters-in-law, and then as the second wife, the third wife. And then I really look at the research and pop psychology and pop culture that supports my thesis. For a novel, because I've been so structured in my nonfiction, I have a sort of, you know, similar take on how I create the book.
We will talk much more with the author. I want to say Susanna Marin, because that's your pen name. The author of a poem.
And by the way, Marin was my grandma's maiden name.
Oh, so that's how you chose it.
Yes, she spelled it differently, M-A-R-I-N, but and probably it was shortened. She
was from Marinovitz or Marinovich
or
something
like that. Yeah, one of those, yeah. So it means a lot to me, both names.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Susan Shapiro-Barish will be back with us in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, McFetch or McFell, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, in Israel, the law of return has long specified that if you have one Jewish grandparent, you're accepted as a Jew for purposes of immigration and as a citizen. That is not always been accepted by the Orthodox rabbinate, the Rabbanut. So there's always been a little bit of a conflict, maybe not so little. Sometimes it's come to a head in kind of bad ways. Nowadays, there's been a change in how Jews who have converted from certain communities are treated. And let's talk about that a little bit because it's important.
Okay, so there's really a couple of distinct issues here. The first is that the law of return, which guarantees any Jew in the world the right to become an Israeli citizen upon simple declaration, I have a Jewish grandparent, whatever, that at least didn't used to involve the Israeli rabbinate, which would say you're only Jewish if your mother's Jewish and you can prove it. If your father's Jewish or if just one grandparent happens to be Jewish, you're not Jewish as far as we're concerned for purposes of weddings, funerals, whatever.
Basically,
which are all the domain of the rabbinate.
Right.
But
any life cycle event is the domain of the rabbinate.
Well, but for many people, Aliyah, immigrating to Israel, is a life cycle event. It may be the life cycle event.
And yet that's not under the control of the rabbinate, actually.
Right. However, now the Minister of the Interior, who controls this whole process, is an extremely Orthodox fellow who is cozying up with the rabbinate and making it tougher and tougher. And the specific case that made international news this week has to do with so-called group conversions, which are done in many places. The example I know best is in the Balkan Peninsula, where, you know, many people who have a Jewish grandparent or a Jewish parent, whether father or mother, consider themselves as Jews, associate with the Jewish community, are active members of the Jewish community, but according to Israel, rabbinic law...
May not be halachically Jewish.
Are right? not Jewish, right. And therefore... Okay.
Right.
So, in recent years, various groups of Orthodox rabbis, including Chabad, as far as I know, have performed like group conversions with people who identify clearly as Jews, who come to services, who play in the Maccabiata when they're kids, all those things. They get together a group of 30 of these people, maybe sprinkle some water, say a bracha or two, and declare them Jewish. And that, at least until now, has been accepted in Israel for purposes of the law of return. What is arising now are communities and places where there's essentially no Jewish history or continuity of Jewish presence. Little groups in Peru or Uganda or whatever, unlike the Jews of Ethiopia and unlike some of the Jews of India, but not all.
Like the B'nai Menashe are included in that, but go ahead.
In those places where there's a quote-unquote recognized Jewish community, the authority of a group conversion is recognized, but in other places, basically newer communities, group conversion is no longer acceptable, and a bunch of Peruvians were just thrown out of Israel because they were ruled by the Supreme Court to have no right to be there. So I don't know if this is the ascendancy of the rabbinate in Israel over the theoretically secular minister of the interior or what, but it is becoming harder and harder to invoke the law of return and to claim your right to live in Israel.
Yeah, a little bit distressing. Law of return, of course, originally decided that if you could be executed by the Nazis for having one Jewish grandparent, then you could come to Israel and it would be your safe haven as a Jew if you had one Jewish grandparent, right?
Right.
And it's distressing, I think, for a lot of us to see that. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, and I look forward to our next session.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The local bar was so sure that its bartender was the strongest man in the world, they offered a standing $1,000 bet. The bartender would squeeze a lemon until all the juice ran into a glass, then hand the lemon to a patron. Anyone who could squeeze one more drop of juice out would win the $1,000. Many people tried over the years, football players, weightlifters, longshoremen, but nobody could do it. One day, this scrawny little Jewish guy came into the bar wearing thick glasses and a bad suit and said in a squeaky voice, "I'd like to try the bet." The laughter dies down, and the bartender says, "Okay," grabs a lemon, squeezes away. Then he hands the wrinkled remains of the rind to the Jewish fellow. But the crowd's laughter turns to total silence. The man clenches his fist around the lemon, and six drops fall into the glass. The crowd cheers. The bartender pays out the $1,000. Then he asks the little Jewish man, "What do you do for a living? Are you a lumberjack, a weightlifter, what?" And the little Jewish fellow replies, "I raise money for the Jewish Federation." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Saturday morning in Reform congregations on Rosh Hashanah and Sunday morning in Conservative and Orthodox congregations will read a special Rosh Hashanah portion, the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedat Yitzchak, when God tests Abraham by having him almost, but not quite, sacrifice Isaac on a rock. As we remember the trauma of Isaac and the faith and struggle of Abraham, we know that on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur we stand before God, open to the judgment that comes on Yom HaDin, the day of decision. May we come to know the openness that this judgment requires, and so atone honestly for our sins and errors over the past year. Poet Chaim Guri has an interpretation of this tale from a very different direction. This translation is by my teacher, Ted Carmi, Alav HaShalom, may he rest in peace. It's called Yerusha, Heritage. The ram came last of all, and Abraham did not know that it came to answer the boy's question, first of his strength, when his day was waning. The old man raised his head, seeing that it was no dream and that the angel stood there, the knife slipped from his hand. The boy, released from his bonds, saw his father's back. Isaac, the story goes, was not sacrificed. He lived for many years, saw what was good in life until his eyesight dimmed. But he bequeathed that hour to his offspring. They are born with a knife in their hearts. A powerful and troubling message of testing and mortality in this holiest of seasons. We stand before God now, as Abraham and Isaac both did, and we face a unique challenge. Knowing our mortal status, can we rise to affirm our essential holiness? In this strangest of times and years, can we seek to be good and to treat everyone around us with genuine decency as fellow images of God? It is a great and grave challenge, but one we are able to meet provided we give our heart to it, damaged or whole. When we return on to Jewish Our Guest, Susan Shapiro Barish will explain how her Judaism influenced her entire career as a popular novelist, and in the deep nonfiction work she did exploring the nature of women today, all when we return on to Jewish. Just a moment.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel is poised to return all of its citizens to lockdown just before Rosh Hashanah next week in a decisive action that comes as the country's coronavirus outbreak spirals out of control. Israel recorded more than 4,000 new cases in one day last week and 22 new deaths, both records for a day. Israel's now hurtled past the grim 1,000 death threshold, and it now has the highest per capita new infection rate in the world. Not a title you want. The daily case total in Israel would be the equivalent of 150,000 new cases daily in the U.S. God forbid. The move to lock the entire country of Israel down comes after days of political jockeying over how to rein in an increasingly desperate health crisis. Leaders in the country's Haredi ultra-Orthodox sector resisted any restrictions that specifically targeted their communities. Now the government is on the verge of approving draconian restrictions that will shutter most businesses and public institutions and require Israelis to stay within 500 meters, about a quarter mile, of their homes. This lockdown will prevent public prayer services from taking place during Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the biggest, most important, holiest holidays of the Jewish calendar. After a two-week period, according to reports, some restrictions will be lifted in Israel, but schools will remain closed for another 2 weeks, under the terms of the plan reportedly under consideration. Israeli schools, which some public health experts blame for the virus's rebound in the country after it initially seemed to curb its outbreak this spring, open September 1st for the school year. In California, well, online, but sponsored from California, a Palestinian hijacker is scheduled to speak at a virtual roundtable discussion organized by, you guessed it, San Francisco State University. Lila Khalid was part of a team that hijacked TWA Flight 840 on its way from Rome to Tel Aviv back in August of 1969. In 1970, she participated in an attempted hijacking of an El Al flight from Amsterdam to New York City as part of the Dawson's Field hijackings, a series of simultaneous hijackings carried out by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Leila Khaled was arrested in London, where the pilot diverted the plane, and was later released in exchange for hostages from another hijacking. She lives now in Amman, Jordan. She's now 76 years old. Khaled will speak as part of a September 23rd event organized by San Francisco State University's Department of Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diasporas Studies called Teaching Palestine. Her discussion is titled, Whose Narratives? Gender, Justice, and Resistance, a Conversation with Leila Khaled. She is billed as a Palestinian feminist, militant, and leader. You know, not a hijacker. Jewish groups in San Francisco, as well as national Jewish organizations, slammed the university's decision to give Khaled a platform. An invitation to a public figure to speak to a class should not be construed as an endorsement of that point of view, said a statement from San Francisco State University's President Lynn Mahoney. Higher education and the college experience are an opportunity to hear divergent ideas, viewpoints, and accounts of life experiences. We recognize that the exercise of free speech and academic freedom can result in discomfort or pain for others. Khaled reportedly still has ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, classified as a terrorist organization in the U.S., Canada, Israel, and the European Union. Among the groups that have criticized the university are the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, American Jewish Committee, San Francisco Hillel, and the local Jewish Community Relations Council. A feature film about the life of Nicholas Winton, who saved 669 children from the Nazis, is in production with Oscar winner Anthony Hopkins in the lead role. One Life has Hopkins playing an older Winton. British actor Johnny Flynn portrays the young Nicholas Winton. Winton, nicknamed the British Schindler, died in 2015 at the age of 106. The baptized son of Jewish parents, Winton was a 29-year-old stockbroker when he arrived in Prague in December of 1938. He was planning to go on a ski holiday in Switzerland, but changed his plans when he heard about the refugee crisis in Czechoslovakia, as it was then called, which had just been occupied by the Nazis. In the following 9 months, he organized 8 trains carrying children, the vast majority of them Jewish, from Czechoslovakia to safety in Britain. Winton's heroism was unremarked until the 1980s, when his wife, in the attic, found evidence of all of his rescues. The discovery led to a surprise reunion with some of the children and a documentary film. Nicholas Winton received many honors in his later years, including a knighthood, all of which he considered to be unnecessary. An amazing man. Hope it's a good movie. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Susan Shapiro Barish, is the author of 13 nonfiction women's issues books and fiction under the pen name of Susanna Marin. She has a new book out, A Palm Beach Scandal. You spoke earlier about the secrets women keep in order to appear the way they want to appear. Don't men keep these same secrets?
Well, it can't be the same, because we live and will die in a patriarchal culture. And when you live in a world where, despite great gains for women occur, there's still male supremacy. And so men don't need to be quite as acrobatic as women need to be in order to survive, in order to appear as they want to appear. So it's really a very different journey for men than women.
I've always thought that there's, certainly it's a patriarchal culture. Certainly women struggle to achieve what men sometimes just are given in our society. But isn't there also a kind of assumption that it's men who are the ones who have extramarital affairs, and that I don't know who they have them with because the women are not the ones who are having them? Isn't there some of that assumption in society?
There's a tremendous amount of assumption when it comes to female infidelity. I started the research on that in the early 90s, and it was really something that people almost didn't want to hear about, you know. But in fact, women have affairs because they're either unhappy in their marriage or they want a very different experience, and they stay in the marriage because of children, or it's a self-esteem issue, or they simply fall in love unexpectedly. And in any of these cases, the women are very good at keeping the secret and keeping the affair going.
Palm Beach has been much in the news the last few years. You set this novel and the previous one in Palm Beach. Why?
So my parents were residents of Palm Beach for, I'd say, almost 5 decades.
Wow.
Until my beloved mother died 2.5 years ago. They had a home there. And they were so happy there, particularly my mother. And I would go visit every holiday and every break, you know, school break, because I'm a college professor. And I would walk down the avenue, 4th Avenue, with my mother. And I would, and two things really struck me, Rabbi. One was that women of all ages seemed to have agency, that they all seemed so content and confident. And since ageism is such a big deal for women in our country, I was really struck by that. And the other thing is that everyone seems so happy, and could they really be that happy based on all of my research? And what secrets did they keep, I kept thinking? And what is it to be so fortunate as to live in a place of great beauty and privilege, and yet, as we know, with life, there are always complications everywhere we go.
So doesn't money somehow make it more complicated?
Well, in a capitalistic society, it certainly has great, great weight and a great effect on our lives. And sometimes the irony is, and again, this goes to my research for my nonfiction books on how women live and feel all across the country, whether you have a degree from Harvard or you've barely finished high school, whether your husband is a multimillionaire or your husband is a bus dispatcher. The idea that emotional yearnings for women are really just everywhere, that we all want. Like, for instance, I wrote a book. This is a book, this novel, Palm Beach Scandal, is the story of a mother and her two adult daughters in Palm Beach, and a very deep-seated family secret that becomes known, and how each of them deals with it. Well, that reflects something that can happen anywhere, but in Palm Beach, the bar is held so high, and the judgments are so great, and that really intrigues me.
You mentioned that it's kind of a genre book, right? Explain how you chose to enter this sort of genre for your fiction writing.
Well, I'm endlessly fascinated by how women really feel, as I've said earlier today.
Of course, yeah.
And I really think that women are discerning readers of fiction and are looking to be transported by a story, and they identify so strongly with the characters that they read about. And so that seems to be the right effect. I like that type of story. And I really, the funny thing is, I started as a fiction writer. So I studied fiction writing undergrad, and then I was lucky enough to earn my master's degree in fiction writing and literature, but Ed Doctorow, Yale Doctorow, the writer, the great writer, was my
Yale Doctorow. Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing writer.
So I was really amazing writer and a wonderful mentor.
It's good to hear that.
Does your
and he was Jewish.
Yeah, I was about to say, you know, I was about to say, people don't know Yale Doctorow was Jewish, which is funny. It's not true that all great writers are Jewish, but a lot. How does your Judaism affect the way you write?
My Judaism affects everything. It's just at the center of my life. I mean, I'm always aware of it. And I have such an affinity for this religion. So while my books are not like that, and religion is not what's really driving the story.
Certainly not central in the story.
Yeah, it's not central in the story, but I'm keenly aware of it as the person I am.
You have a really interesting sister relationship in Palm Beach Scandal. Is it based on anything in your own life?
Well, it's really completely, you know, these are completely invented characters.
Sure.
But I will tell you that I have two daughters with a son in the middle, and that my mother was the youngest of three sisters. And so when I wrote, as I was telling you about some of the titles I've done for the nonfiction books, one book that really, really was such a great one to research was the book I wrote called Sisters Devoted or Divided. And I realized that the sister bond, because I don't have one, I only have a brother, the sister bond is so compelling. And when it works, it's just, it makes life so much richer. And when there's an upset in a sister relationship, the sisters really, really feel it.
And it's such a complicated relationship.
Really complicated. In fact, in the novel, in the beginning, no spoiler here, but beginning.
Well, with Elodie and Aubrey, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Right, with the sisters, Elodie, the older sister, and Aubrey, her younger sister. So Elodie is married, and she's done all the right things. She's just around 40, and her sister Aubrey is 8 years younger and is the more ethereal, dreamy sister who hasn't followed the path we would expect our children and our sisters to follow. So they're in a car together, and her boyfriend asks, they talk about a study, the four of them, where in the magazine, where, and then the question becomes, if you're in a lifeboat and you're with your husband and your sister and there's one life raft, who do you throw it to? And that's a really good question. Right, that's a good one.
I love lifeboat ethics. They're great.
Yeah, they're always great.
Like, who are you going to throw overboard here? Well, might be the husband, I suspect. I don't know.
Oh, that husband. Yeah, all those husbands. That's what women say.
Yeah, I suspect. The complication, and I don't think I'm giving anything away here, is her sister asked her to ask Aubrey, the younger sister, to carry her child. And this is a real situation today. You know, the notion of surrogacy, it makes the whole novel really, really hinges on that. Plus, of course, this dark secret, well, deep secret that we're not going to reveal here.
Right, no spoilers.
Yeah, how did you research that?
Well, years ago, I was actually commissioned to write a book on infertility and gestational carrier, and interestingly, the book was postponed, and ultimately never got published.
Oh.
Because I started the research in the 90s, and the world almost wasn't ready for it then.
Huh.
But I did go to the Center for Surrogate Parenting in L.A., and I did get to speak with the lawyer for the Baby M case, and I did a lot of really serious research for that project. And it's always stayed with me, because in the book that I just mentioned before that I'd written on sisters,
mm-hmm.
There is a chapter on the infertile sister asking her sister to carry the baby. And then the idea of it is just so complex. It's loaded, and it's also a blessing. So I really wanted to take a look at how that would play out for these very disparate sisters. They're very different in style and in their goals in life.
And that happens. You know, my mom used to say she had four only children. Siblings are not always similar. Is it fun to play that out when you write it?
Well, it really was compelling to write this story. And I had also recently written a book on mothers and daughters, and I interviewed mothers of daughters from 3 years old to over 30. And the book is called You're Grounded Forever, But First Let's Go Shopping. So I think that says a lot about the mother-daughter bond. So the other part of this story...
By the way, I love that. You know, you're grounded forever, but first let's go shopping.
Exactly, because that's exactly what it's like to be a mother to a daughter.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think 90% of the women in this study told me that it was much more complicated for them to mother their daughters than their sons if they had both if they had both, boys and girls. But in this novel, in A Palm Beach Scandal, I was really looking for the mother as it's a really, truly triangulated relationship. So we've got the two sisters and their mother. And when the secret, again, we can't give it away.
When the secret is
discovered, how does the mother react? And to which daughter does she sort of move, more protectively toward?
It's always interesting. I do think, by the way, it's harder, speaking as a father, to me it's much harder to parent a daughter than a son.
Right, so you feel the same. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's much more complicated. Partly, of course, gender difference, but it's more than that. It's just not as simple. It's not as straightforward.
One daughter, but so I can only speak to that, but it's definitely more complicated.
Well, it has so much to do with the societal expectations for a female in our society, in our culture.
I think that's true, and even if you work against that, your daughter's going to experience that. There's no way to avoid it. It's part of the way things work.
Because we have her nature, and then we have the nurturing, and the nurturing is all the societal messaging that she's bombarded with.
Well, and not to mention like the Jewish aspect of it too. There's a certain expectation, although the expectation for Jewish women is that they will be outspoken, they will be strong.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really healthy. I think it's right. I don't always feel good about it. When I had three teenagers in the house at the same time, I was wrong for 7 years. But still.
You know what I used to say to my children? I used to say to them when they were teenagers, wow, it must be great to think you know everything.
It was when I was 17. I remember that, so at least I could relate to it. I want to thank Susan Shapiro Barish for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her book is called A Palm Beach Scandal. It's fun, but it's also complicated and rich. Where can people go to find out more about you and the book?
They can go to my website, either Susan Shapiro Barish or Susanna Marin. It will come up and everything is there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. The High Holy Days are coming up this Friday, Saturday, and the following week, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Join Beit Simcha for our unique blended online and very limited live seating by calling 520-276-5675 or emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org or go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org. Don't miss our live drive-in second night celebration on September 19th, Saturday night, with music, shofar, and much more, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and friends. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus sorus, join us every Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. will hold services with full music by virtual experience for the time being, with a very limited number of blended people allowed to be there. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, a great array of them. You can access that by emailing us at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Jolla on the north side, on the entrance to the Foothills Mall. Not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. For now, we're a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook with some blended services. Email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, to get more information on Beit Simcha. To attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and of course all of our services, both on Zoom and Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from the upcoming High Holy Days. It's now less than a week away, this Friday. Don't forget to make arrangements to attend High Holy Day services at Congregation Beit Simcha with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, this year. You can call 520-276-5675 or email rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. And come to our drive-in second night Rosh Hashanah celebration at the Gaslight Theater this Saturday night. A great in-person, outdoor, fun, safe celebration of the Jewish New Year. Our playout this morning is from cantor David Fisher, Chazan Dudu Fisher, singing Shana Tova for the new year that begins Friday night at sundown. Join us next Sunday, also next year, technically, 5781. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Greg Schneider, Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference, on the new survey of Holocaust knowledge among millennials and Gen Z, as well as the effort to remove Holocaust denial from Facebook. My friends, may you have a Shana Tova Umetuka, a good, sweet new year of blessings, a healthy year, and God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, and a much better year, we pray, of health and of peace. Slicha gam ahava tavi pius vegam shalva yamim holchim yamim baim silchi gam at lachataim rab icholim simchi noflim Bechesed uverachamim Shana tova Kirvi halom Ve'yad hoshiti leshalom Shana tova
Shana tova
Shana tova
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.